right, welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm going to be your host tonight, Tom Perry, and I'm also joined by one of my good buddies, John Larson. What's up, John?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me, man. Appreciate it. I'm also very honored and kind of excited to have on our guest tonight, Levi Peterson. I guess I should say Professor Levi Peterson, who is a Mormon biographer, essayist, fictionist, and he's best known for his book, The Backslider, and also for his biography on Juanita Brooks. I should say his award-winning book on Juanita Brooks. And he's also an emeritus professor of English at Weber State University. And he's edited Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, from 2004 to 2008. And I also should mention, for those of you podcast fans out there, he's also interviewed by John DeLynn, or AKA Mormon Stories, back in 2007. And that interview, I personally highly recommend. So Levi, or Professor Peterson, welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. One of the reasons why we wanted to have you on originally, Levi, is I guess it was just last month. Is that right, John? When we had a discussion on The Backslider?
Yeah, it was in January, just like the second week of January.
Yeah, we talked about having a book club, kind of a series thing, a monthly book club podcast. And John had mentioned that the book that he wanted to start off with was The Backslider, your book. And he's told me multiple times that's one of his favorite books. Is that right? I don't want to put words in your mouth when you're right here, man.
Yeah, when you think about Mormon literature, there's of course, not that much to choose from, but the best by far and away. And, you know, like I said in the book club, I think it stands on its own outside of Mormon literature is the Backslider, which is probably as much about Utah culture and Southern Utah culture as it is about Mormonism.
And Levi, you'd mentioned that you'd actually listened to that our book club podcast. Is that right?
Right.
And you thought it was terrible, or you thought it was okay?
Oh, I was interested. One of the commentators, a young woman, even noted how many different words my character Frank Wyndham or terms knew for masturbation. That young woman read that novel rather closely, I'd say.
the book, you know, I have roots that go back to San Pete County, Ephraim and Manti, and the book just speaks to me so much from those old timers from down there and how they think and how they process the world.
Well, you see, I grew up in a Mormon town in northern Arizona, Snowflake. And even though it's in Arizona, it has an awfully lot in common with little Mormon towns in Utah and Idaho. And I used to travel from Provo to Snowflake when I was in college and pass through Garfield County and Panguitch and that Kanab and that area down there, and thought this would be a good place to grow up. So I decided to set a novel down there. That's where I actually roamed about Garfield County. I subscribed to the Garfield County News for 5 years as background to writing The Backslider, so that I tried to get my setting and the local color realistically as I could.
You know, I've talked to friends who grew up in the area, and they say the same thing. So. Now it was set in the 40s, or it's set way back in time, isn't it?
Mid 1950s. There's actually one reference that lets you date it. There was an airplane crashed in the Grand the airliner crashed in the Grand Canyon. I think that was 1956, and that was referred to in one of the conversations in the book. Otherwise, I didn't peg down a date on it, but that lets you do it. Mid 1950s.
So, what is it about that time that compelled you to set it then?
Well, I was 19.
I
wanted to, even though the novel's about me, I wanted to be accurate. You know, I wanted to take a part of the world I knew. But I don't know. I don't suppose it matters too much when it was set. Fiction has kind of a universal appeal, I think, regardless of the era it's set in.
Well, the reason I think that's interesting is because the book still seems timeless to me. You know, when I was reading it this last time, and I ran onto that again, you know, that it was dated. He talked about his father dying. I was almost struck aback because to me, it could play today just as well as it played at that time. So those themes that you're dealing with haven't really changed.
Yeah, well, the landscape is a lot the same down in that country. For one thing. Another thing, like it or not, rural Mormons are quite a bit the same now as they used to be. And while there have been some complaint, justified, I suppose, that my main characters are my chief Mormon characters, Frank and his mother, and maybe several others are grotesque, or particularly if you're looking at Jeremy, they aren't typical Mormons, and that's true, as Frank himself recognizes. But I think a lot of those secondary characters in the book, you can still find them in the rural Mormon world, even today. Grew up with so many rural Mormons around me, and stayed in touch with so many of them, it just seemed like to me that it was natural to portray them.
So let's talk a second about the cowboy Jesus. I think that, you know, a lot of the people who we had listened to and read it, and a lot of the feedback I got, talked about how that was so moving and so touching for them. So I want to kind of probe your thoughts a little bit about your interpretation of the cowboy Jesus.
Well, I thought all along, long before I even settled down to writing the chapters of the novel, that I was going to have a character who was letting his sins burden him so deeply and heavily that he was considering doing away with himself and ritualistically, you know, via the old Mormon system of blood atonement. And I wanted to save him. That was going to be the climax of the novel. So the suspense of the novel would be the question whether he would be saved, and I assumed from the start that he would undergo some kind of dramatic change. It would be either psychological change, I mean, coming from within his own psyche, or given the kind of Mormon he was, it could be a vision. And while modern Mormons don't have visions much, they certainly believe in them. And the further back in time you go, the more Latter-day Saints who believed in vision. My own relatives did, and some of them still do. But it had to be what kind of saving vision or epiphany Frank would have, I was at a loss to know. I that's what I wanted, but I got to thinking the stereotypical vision of Jesus and God coming down to Joseph Smith. You know, you have the paintings of Joseph kneeling in the woods, and there. God the Father and God the Son, transcendently dressed in white and hovering above the ground. That wouldn't have been a vision that fit my rough-hewn Frank Windham. And I had to actually was into the final chapter of the book in my writing, writing a fairly advanced draft, before it occurred to me to use the cowboy Jesus. Now, the cowboy Jesus is a kind of highly coincidental figure in the novel up to that point. Early in the first chapter, in fact, Mary Ann, who's just barely become acquainted with Frank, muses on this little daydream she has, that she meets, she's in the woods, and she meets a man on horseback, and it turns out to be Jesus, and he says, "You're lost, but now you're found." And so she repeats that a couple of times in the book, this little whimsy, this little fancy, and that's what turns into Frank's vision. It occurred to me that, that kind of an epiphany a guy like Frank might really have. Now, he's had visions before, but they've been the negative ones that convinced him he was utterly evil and that God intended to punish him. But this vision that turns him around and makes him feel saved, and that was the point of it, of course, was to allow Frank to take advantage of the Christian doctrine of atonement, of forgiveness, of grace. Mormons don't quite like to believe in free grace. They think you got to buy your grace tickets by good works. That's where they stand. But I suppose critics have said Frank's Jesus is a mainline Protestant Jesus, and there may be some truth to that. But I wasn't trying to take a theological stand when I conceived of that kind of Jesus. But it needed to be somebody that would fit Frank's mentality and give Frank the kind of advice he needed, which was to, well, for example, that Mary Ann's one hell of a good woman, and you ought to enjoy her. So that's where the cowboy Jesus came from.
But isn't it also true, Levi, that one of the higher criticisms that you usually get for this book, with as far as the cowboy Jesus goes, is the fact that he smokes, and how irreverent that kind of portrayal is?
Yes. Well, also the vision occurs with Frank's at the urinal.
Yeah,
that bothers a lot of people. bothers my good friend at BYU, Richard Krakoff, now retired professor down there, who wrote about, you know, my God, my Jesus wasn't a Mormon Jesus at any rate.
Well, that leads to my next question. So it's been, has it been 25 years, or has it been more than that since the book came out?
It was published in 1986, so it is
25. How has it been received? How has it been accepted? You know, my fear is that because it pushes boundaries a little bit like that, that it would have been ignored by a lot of the mainstream Mormons. How has it been received?
Well, it is never sold on the scale that popular Mormon novels sell on, even when it was first out. We're talking in terms of thousands of copies rather than tens of thousands of copies of it sold. However, it is still in print and has never been out of print, and it's existed in the first slick cover trade paperback, a nice one, and then that one was photographically duplicated and sold as a $5, $6 paperback book, and that's sold and sold and sold. That's the large majority of the copies have been that one. And then recently, a couple of years ago, maybe it's been a little bit longer than that, Signature Book went put it out in a totally new edition with hardback and illustrations, kind of fancy. It's a fairly expensive book, but it's still around, and it still sells, and I get not an awfully lot of letters, but I suppose one or nearly one a month from somebody that's just discovered it or finally got around to reading it and wants to talk to me about it. So, and I answer those letters, and that's enheartening. So I've never felt like I have a great fame, but it's enheartening that people keep reading it.
Have they ever picked it up at BYU? Has any English professor down there ever used it?
Well, Gene England used it regularly till he died, but of course Gene was in trouble with the brethren down there, he got in trouble with the brother McConkie and kind of got squeezed out at BYU, but as long as he was there, well, and then when he went over to USV, Utah Valley, he took it with him, had it in his class. So, yeah, he did at BYU. It's been used in other Utah universities. It's been used out of state in two other states I know of, universities. A friend of mine back east, he's a Gentile friend in Indiana, had it for an honors class. It wasn't a big class. There were about 10 or 12 students, but none of them were Mormon. But they liked it, and they particularly commented on the effectiveness of the vision of the cowboy Jesus. It seems to have vision, incidentally, has struck some people as scripture, a little eerie almost, that more than one person has written to me saying, I read it seven times, somebody, a woman told me, and couldn't get enough of it.
Wow.
Back over it, and as if it had really, really happened. A woman at a party one night told me that when she read it, for the first time, gave her some hope for her father who had committed suicide. She decided he was going to be damned, but decided to, well, maybe not, you know, having read The Backslider. A cousin of mine gave it to a couple of his backsliding friends, and started going to church again. I had no idea that it would have that kind of effect. I thought, in fact, it'd do the opposite. But
well, one of the main themes in the book, Levi, is kind of a guilt or remorse or even kind of a depression. Did you, when you were writing the book, were you kind of writing from your own personal experience, or just were you just kind of diving into an imaginary kind of landscape there?
Well, guilt is the driving force in Frank's conflict, and the climax, the resolution of the conflict, is that he gets past his guilt. Guilt's a big thing with me. People have told me that's all you write about, Levi. That's driving all your conflicts, and there's some truth to that. Not entirely, but I just finished a short story last week, there it is again, same old theme, guilt driving it, and I think I inherited a very healthy dose of guilt from the environment I grew up in. I've done a lot of thinking about where that came from, and it's still there. I I'm willing to feel guilty about almost anything. The deterioration of the environment and global warming and the starvation in Africa. You name it, I feel guilty about it. So I have used it in my fiction.
Well, it's something that resonates with me. I know that was a strong underpinning of my Mormon upbringing. So that's where I find the redemptive quality of the book, you know, under so much of what I think is ever present in a negative way in our culture, is its really redeeming message and what makes it such a great influence.
You know, my mother in her old age, my wife and I, when we were still living in Ogden, we took our turn at having my mother come and stay with us when she was too old to live alone. And she'd be with us 6 weeks in the spring, and it was pleasant having her, and she entertained herself all day long crocheting afghans out of heavy-duty wool yarn, and it kind of helped her keep her sanity, being able to make afghans. But on Sunday, because making afghans was her work, her weekly work, she deprived herself of the pleasure of crocheting afghans. And Sundays, that we, Alfie and I quickly learned, were hellish for my mother. She'd go to church with us. We'd take her to church and do the three-hour block of meetings, and then we'd eat together, and she'd write a letter or two and read a little scripture, and then she'd just get bored and stamp around the house and nervous and moody and angry, and I'd say to her, I don't think Heavenly Father would care if the elderly woman did a little knitting on the Sabbath, but she wouldn't have any of that. That was work, and she wouldn't go to work on Sunday. Well, that was right the year I was riding the backslider. I could see where I got my guilt from. My mother, the God my mother believed in, sold his blessings at a high price. And I think more Mormons than willing to admit it feel that way. But anyway, that's probably where my guilt came from. My mother.
Well, I think it. I hope you take a little bit of pride in the book 25 years later. I mean, at least with our podcast, the fact that John Larson said that this was the book that he wanted to lead off with, and that it's still resonating with people nowadays. I think that's kind of a really nice pat on the back for you, Professor.
Well, thank you. I feel that I worked it and reworked it till it was, there's very little in it I would change. And I can't say that about a lot of things I've written and published. The idiom, which is kind of a mix between Frank's way of thought and my own, I wouldn't change it. The truth is, I reread the book quite a bit. I don't mean from start to finish, but when I'm in a house of a friend or my daughter's house and a little time hanging on my hands, I'll pull the backslider off the bookshelf and browse in it. And I'll think, well, I did that all right. There's no reason to change that. So that I feel like it's artistically the best thing I've done in terms of literary art.
Well, I don't know, John, if it's all right if I go to Juanita Brooks.
Yeah, let's talk about dear old Juanita.
Okay, I just want to preface this by saying that I've been reading the book pretty heavily this week, and I have to say that I have such a deep respect. I had a deep respect for Juanita Brooks before I was reading through your biography, but reading through your biography, which I think is incredibly well written, and it's obviously well written enough to win some awards, but I just wanted to know what are your overall thoughts of her as a woman, as a historian? I mean, if you could just kind of summarize your own personal thoughts of her, what would it be?
She's I studied her life so closely. I had so much information on her that it'd be pretty hard to know her better without being one of her children or her husband. I thought, and I did, and she held up. Even her little foibles, which I came to know quite well, it didn't reduce my respect and my admiration for her. She's a very homespun person. That people use that word in relation to her, and it's a good word for her, but a plain person, both in appearance and in her spoken words, but extraordinary personality and one of my true heroes. And I admired her in a superficial way when I started the research for the biography, and rather than respecting her less, I respected her even more when I was through with it. As I say, the more, the better I got to know her, the more I respected her. Though she's female and I'm male and we're of different generations, she could have easily been my mother. There are a lot of similarities between us that I've noted. That she's we're both from rural, little rural towns. She from Bunkerville, Nevada, near St. George, and me from Snowflake, and we're both raised in large Mormon families. My extended family and her extended family are enormous, and we both picked up on family. I have a very strong value and sense of family, and she certainly did. And furthermore, she's a dissenter among the Mormons. She's a faithful Mormon, no question of being a faithful Mormon about her. Believed in Joseph Smith, etc., and the Book of Mormon, and the structure of the church and all, and yet she could see that the church needed a lot of improvement. And while she wasn't what you would call an ardent liberal Mormon, she was a liberal Mormon in her sense of history. She wanted Mormons to look at their own history with a steady eye and not heroicize it. And I respected and admired that in her, that the quality of her dissent from the mainline Mormon attitude and view was one that I agreed with very, very much. As you see, I what I'm adding up to here is that there are just so many similarities between us that I've held her as I say, one of my own true heroes.
Yeah, when you call her a dissenter, but yet she's a loyal Mormon through and through, and she stayed faithful for the most part. But most of her life, if not the majority of her life, was defined by her conflict with her position in the church or her stance against the Brethren or what she wanted to say and what she stood for. I think that's one of her defining aspects, is that she was a person that was trying to make change but still wanted to be loyal to the church. Would that be fair to say?
Right. She my biography of her is a very dense book. It's 500 pages, and it's got 1,500 end notes in it, et cetera. But she, if I wrote about the, had written about the, what you might call the drama of her life, the conflict she got into with the brethren and with the other relatives and other Latter-day Saints for having insisted on setting forth the details of the Mountain Meadows Massacre and the scapegoating of John D. Lee as frankly and realistically as she did. The book I would have written about her would have been maybe 150 pages long. One of my passions as I settled into my research on her, because there was such an abundance of material on her, was for once in my life I wanted to do a research project that was total. And I was curious to see what a famous person's whole life would be. And so I portray her in her relationship to her children and her ward and her stake and her sister and sisters and casual people. And she was a school teacher and she was a housewife and she was Relief Society president, as well as an author and as well as a historian. So I fleshed it out in great detail and got criticized for it. A number of critics said that I had too much mundane detail in the book. There are other people that say the contrary. They like that mundane detail, but it is mundane detail. It's the everyday doings She, most of her letters, her writings about herself were largely not in diaries. They were in on the carbons of letters she wrote to friends. She wrote copious letters to all friends and strangers, anybody that wrote her. She'd answer them usually a full-page letter or densely typed, and she'd always slip a carbon into her typewriter, and that carbon became the record of her life. And as I say, I made nearly 1,500 photocopies of her letters. That was the basis of my material that I wrote about. So I got a lot of that everyday detail about her in the book.
Well, along these lines, I highlighted three excerpts that I really enjoyed that you had quoted from her, and if you'll humor me, I want to read some of these. One of the quotes is on page 177 of your biography of her. It says, "Her ward bishopric was selling subscriptions to the Deseret News to finance a movie projector. When the ward representatives dropped by, Juanita made clear her attitude toward the Republican orientation of the church-owned newspaper. Quote, anyway, when they came here," she wrote Morgan, "I told them that I wanted to be a good member of the church, but I hadn't had a chance if I read the news. It made me so blankety mad that I lost even my standing as a Christian. I might add that I contributed $3 to the movie machine, but did not subscribe for the news. So now I'll be counted as an apostate for sure." I think I was laughing out loud when I read that. I think that's so great.
And
in another one, this is on page 171, just before that, it says, "In reference to anti-Mormon literature, I am in fact in a state of apostasy, perhaps, with many of the practices and teachings of our church. I simply cannot accept them and retain my intellectual independence, which I do try to maintain, and yet I am loyal to it. I think it is as much my church as it is J. Reuben Clark's or anyone else's." I think that kind of symbolizes what her stance was and why she stayed so faithful, even with the direct conflict within her mind of the things that she'd been studying. That was such a great line.
Good point. Yeah.
But this last quote that I want to read, and this is what I wanted to talk to you about the chapter even in your book that says the book that she was born to write about the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Right.
And she this is what she says before the Utah Academy in 1940. Quote, I didn't want to publish it, in reference to the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I didn't want to publish it because I didn't want to be called in by the authorities, and I was afraid I would be. I don't want to be branded as an old apostate. I didn't want them to say to me, Sister Brooks, we command you in the name of the Lord to stop this, because I know I couldn't stop even if were I so commanded. You know, that the integrity that she had was just off the charts. I mean, the conditions that she had to write that book, it's astounding to me. I mean, you obviously studied the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and just even studying her life, what are your thoughts about the integrity, her courage in writing such a book in that kind of a time frame and under that kind of pressure?
Well, it was unquestionably enormous pressure not to, and she was frightened of excommunication. She expected that she would be, or feared it greatly. And as you read in the biography, she sought one way or another to get apostles or other high-ranking church persons to endorse the book. It was almost pathetic that she had to do that, and they didn't. The point there being she was seeking some kind of shelter from excommunication. She did fear it. And yet, she knew that the massacre had happened, and it struck her as a profound wrong to pull a blanket over it. There's another factor. Being a native of Dixie, southern Utah, she resented the fact that the large majority of Mormons who did know about the massacre, and particularly those clustered around Salt Lake City and the center of the church, were very willing to put the onus of the massacre onto the little handful of colonists down in southwestern Utah, whereas as Juanita, being a historian, knew very well, the spirit that provoked the southern Utah Mormons to commit the massacre, that spirit was born out of the church-wide sufferings that went on in first Kirtland and then Missouri and then Illinois and then on the plains. The people massacred at Mountain Meadows were in reprisal for all those deaths, persecutions, the driving out, the terrible suffering of the saints on the plains. That was all in the background of that. And Juanita knew you can't just load that onto the people in southern Utah. And furthermore, that's what's wrong with trying to make out that the victims of the massacre were it was just a totally dark and criminal act on the part of people who are basically criminals. This is kind of the position that Bagley takes in his book on the massacre. But when you realize that it was vengeance bred in that America at large had asked for, more or less provoked by driving the Mormons as their neighbors had done out of Missouri and Illinois and across the plains, that you couldn't just characterize it as a dark, simple crime. It was an act of war, is what it was, and it was an evil. It was an evil in the way warfare, killing is an evil.
Well, in her book, she actually takes quite a bit of offense, or quite a bit of attention is focused on, it wasn't just John D. Lee, and that he was a scapegoat, pure and simple. And then she explains the other individuals that were much more responsible down there, like Haight and Dame.
Well, yeah, and now the churches, the historians that the church has tolerated and allowed to have at the materials, Turley and Walker, is it? They have, in fact, put the blame more completely on Haight than they do on John D. Lee. That I'm talking about Ronald Walker and Richard Turley and the massacre at Mountain Meadows, but the truth still is that it was John D. Lee that went down and talked those people into putting down their guns and coming out.
Yeah, he's definitely responsible.
I mean, that he had the guts to do it kind of singles him out, and yet, yeah, it's the crime of a lot of people, and the victims didn't ask for it, and they weren't responsible for it, but people like them in the East had prepared for it by the way they treated the Mormons.
Yeah, and what's strange is for Juanita Brooks, she doesn't place the blame of the massacre on Brigham Young, even though she does note that he was kind of complicit in creating an atmosphere for that sort of thing to happen, but also does say that, you know, he didn't order it in the book. Isn't that right?
That's correct. My own judgment would be that he's not stupid. He wouldn't have ordered it. He's not that bloodthirsty either. he had a lot to do with its happening, but of course, circumstances had a lot to do with it. There was a U.S. Army marching toward Utah when the massacre happened. In fact, the Army was entering the valley, wasn't it?
Yeah, or getting ready to. Yeah,
ready to, and when you consider that the Mormons deserted Salt Lake City and prepared the buildings for torching. When the army did come in, it came into an empty city for a while before they came back. You can understand Brigham Young's particular pressures and all in the thing. Juanita, of course, didn't blame Brigham Young for ordering the massacre. She blamed him for help setting up the atmosphere, but she did condemn him for what, in her mind, was a cold-blooded trade-off on letting John D. Lee take the rap for it.
Yeah. Which is interesting to me, because for Juanita Brooks, I mean, she's more or less honored nowadays, even by the new historians that wrote that book, saying that, you know, she really paved the way for their book and for Will Bagley's book and really all the other books that have been done on the massacre. I mean, she really broke ground and really set the standard for it. And it's interesting to me that she was kind of blacklisted back in the day by the church and some of the fellow members of the church for saying what she said, even though she was just stating the truth.
Yeah, well, I suppose that a lot of Latter-day Saints would feel like, you know, there's truths, not all truths should be said.
Yeah.
She was told that quite often, you know, the old, even though my neighbor's got this ugly lump on his nose, I don't tell him about it.
I guess that's true.
Yeah, but so the church, the big flap over the reinstatement of John D. Lee added a lot to the drama of her life. As I say in my biography of her, probably the climactic year of her life was 1961 when that reinstatement took place, and she insisted on publishing it in the biography she was finishing and preparing to publish at that very moment, the biography of John D. Lee.
Yeah, that moment is integral in her life and also in your book. It is the kind of the climactic point of things, because that was when the pressure cooker from the church really got hot. Now, go ahead and correct me when I'm wrong here, but isn't it true that John D. Lee, he got excommunicated without a trial, and then he was also executed for, you know, he was the scapegoat for the massacre. And then John D. Lee's family, and this is in the 50s or the 60s, they petitioned the First Presidency of the Church to try to get his records redone through the temple, to get his temple work redone. Is that right?
Correct.
And then this is where things got a little crazy, is because they kind of wanted to do that privately or not let the public know about it, because, you know, obviously some of the...
Right.
Problems that would create is that the church is reinstating John D. Lee, more or less. And sure enough, well, they did, right? They did approve it.
And I think it was because of Juanita's book, which had been out for 10 years, 11 years when the reinstatement took place, and because even though John D. Lee was guilty of what he was accused of, he wasn't the only person that was guilty. And
absolutely.
And if you're going to punish one, you need to punish them all. And I think the church took the sensible view of it. As far as we human beings are concerned, let's reinstate him, and then we just leave it in God's hands, how God's going to deal with him and the rest of us. And so... that's right. The Lee family petitioned the First Presidency to reinstate John D. Lee, and that spring or early summer of 1961, that it happened. And David O. McKay was president of the church, and they assigned Apostle Stapley, who was from Arizona and in touch with the extensive Lee family down in Arizona. He was the apostle that was kind of the lead man on it, and he was told to inform the Lee family of the reinstatement, but to ask them to just keep it a quiet family affair. Juanita, the instant she learned about it, she wanted to publish the fact of the reinstatement at the end of her biography. And I know the reason she wanted to do it. It was a vindication of her having written the book about the massacre in the first place, meaning that even though it was the truth, it hadn't been welcome. And she'd had an awful lot of rubbing on it the 11 years since it had appeared. And so she was very desirous of having it there. And when it was learned that she was thinking of doing that, she approached the leaders of the Lee family, the Apostle Stapley, of course, forbade her, and
wasn't she kind of threatened?
Well, he had her come to the his office. She met him at in his office in Salt Lake City, and they talked it over, and she tried to persuade him that the Lord wanted that reinstatement in her biography because unforeseen obstacles had prevented it being published up to this point. And she kind of had a testimony that the Lord wanted it in there, and Apostle Stapley slapped the table and says, "It is of the devil," meaning her testimony. So she told the story later that she looked him in the eye and said she had her testimony was as good as his. In fact, I heard it. That got me going on the biography, because I was at in the Special Collections Library at Weber State when she spoke in 1973, and she told about the episode of this very episode, and she said it that way. I looked him in the eye, she said, and I said, I know the will of the Lord in this matter as well as you do, brother. And I admired her. That's what made me read the Mountain Meadows Massacre and the biography of John D. Lee. But my research convinced me that it wasn't, she wasn't nearly that defiant in reality. I think she did tell him she'd had a testimony, but he slapped the table and said it was of the devil. And then the Apostle Stapley told the Lee family in Arizona if they didn't put pressure on Juanita that President McKay was going to rescind the reinstatement. And that struck Juanita as totally fallacious. She thought that she might get excommunicated for doing it, but then rescind the reinstatement seemed a whole entirely unlikely. But at any rate, the Lee family flew her to Phoenix at their expense, and she spent a terrible Saturday there listening to person after person bear testimony that they were not to publish. She shouldn't publish the reinstatement, but she ended up promising that she would not publish the reinstatement in the books that the edition the family had ordered, about 1,000 copies, and she didn't. And she left them feeling that the second edition, where she said she would publish it, was going to be comfortably in the future. But it wasn't. When she got home, she immediately wrote her publisher in California and said, go right on from the first edition and print the second edition. So the second edition, though it's marked 1962, it was actually published within a few weeks of when the first one was published.
So she held her obligation, but just put a very short time frame there. Would
when she got home, Will's diary says how she came home, said she'd had a pleasant time and things were okay and all. And you knew very well from her own, the diary she was keeping herself at that time, that she was just torn asunder emotionally by having to go to Phoenix and take that battering, which she did. But she still didn't back off on publishing it.
Would you say that, I mean, you can't exactly slap a Disney sort of ending to her story, can you? You can't say that, you know, all this happened and then she lived happily ever after. I mean, she was sort of ostracized, even from some of her ward members. Isn't that correct? Even to...
Oh, yeah. I think she lost a lot of status in St. George, and it hurt her. She had a sense of her ostracism, a strong sense. She wasn't called on to teach lessons or called to positions in the church. It affected her status enormously in St. George. However, elsewhere, she became kind of famous and an icon. She was invited to talk in dozens and dozens, hundreds of places over a 20-year period or 30, and she would go if people wouldn't pay her. She'd go at her own expense from Idaho to California. She made numerous public appearances, big groups and little groups, and would tell them this part of the story or that part of the story. So it really spread the whole saga of the Mountain Meadows Massacre. It was probably, she did as much by her oral presentations as the book did itself.
Yeah, I think, it defined her verbally and with her writings. Didn't you also say that you'd met her in real life?
Well, yeah, a number of times. I'd met her briefly and casually and shook her hand a time or two. And my daughter, last time we saw her at a 1976 Mormon History Association conference in St. George, my 11-year-old daughter went to a restroom and got a paper towel and came out and got Juanita's autograph on it. I still have that.
Oh, wow.
Her autograph on a paper towel. So my daughter was impressed with her.
So what about today? Has her name generally been redeemed, or is she still blacklisted, or among the faithful?
Well, I don't think she's blacklisted. I think that precisely because of her book and her, the church is at ease. It's come to terms with the massacre. It doesn't avoid confronting it anymore. Then the evidence of that, I think, is the church-sponsored monuments there at the site itself. President Heakley was very instrumental in getting both the monument that's there above the hill, looking down onto the site, and then the burial site itself has been turned into a really nice monument, and the church owns that ground, and the church is caretaker there of it, and I think that's appropriate. It signifies, I think, it is a kind of confession on the part of the church. Some people want the church to make a public statement of apology, but I don't think it would, and I think that monument, the site now itself, the monuments are a kind of public statement of contrition on the part of the church for it. and it's appropriate. And I think that comes precisely because of Juanita. If she'd lived to see it, she'd have been stunned and astounded, but I think it's just true. She's the reason it happened. And in a way, there's nothing in the whole history of the church that, more tragic than that massacre, not even the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, which Joseph was a hero. And that massacre was a blot upon the character of Mormons collectively. And so in a sense, it was a tragic incident, more tragic, I think, than anything that's happened to Mormons as far as their collective sense of being a single people is concerned.
I think you did a whole lot of good by honoring her and her memory by writing that book, so I commend you for that.
Well, I'm certainly glad I did it, and she was certainly worthy of it. As I say, she's one of my true heroes, a person I've modeled on and kind of used to rely on to bolster my own character and personality.
And as far as the Backslider, it's obviously 25 years running, and it's still having a pretty big impact on people, and especially the Mormon culture. Have you come up with any new words for masturbation then?
Well, you know, it's not my fault. It was old friend brought those up.
Well, Levi, you're truly a living legend among Mormon historians, and it's been a great honor on my part to share an hour with you. So,
yes, I really appreciate you spending the time, and it's been great to kind of pick your brain and dive into some of the research that you've done. I really appreciate it. Thanks again to Levi Peterson for joining us on the show, and also to John Larson for accompanying me for this discussion. Just remember that the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com. You can email us at mail@MormonExpression.com. Thanks.